And so they started out on the last but most onerous leg of the trail. To begin with, Rohan was on her own 2 feet, but leaning heavily on his shoulder. However, before the first hour was over, her knee could no longer take the strain, and she subsided onto a rock on the edge of the pathway. "I'm being an awful nuisance, aren't I?"
"Come on board, lady. Always room for a small one."
With Rohan perched on Nicholas's back, her injured legs sticking out stiffly in front of her, they toiled upwards, but their progress was even slower than it had been the day before. Nicholas was forced to pause and rest at shorter and shorter intervals. On the easier pitches, she dismounted and hopped along on one leg beside him, steadying herself with one hand on his shoulder. Then she would collapse, and he had to lift her to her feet and pull her up onto his back once again. The journey descended into a nightmare, and both of them lost all sense of the passage of time. Hours blended with hours into a single unremitting agony. At one stage they lay beside each other on the path, sick and nauseated with thirst and exhaustion and pain. They'd emptied the water bottle an hour ago, and there was no more on this section of the path. Nothing to drink until they reached the summit and were reunited with the Dandera River.
"Go on. Leave me here," she whispered hoarsely. He sat up immediately and stared at her, aghast. "Don't be silly. I need you for ballast." "It can't be much further to the top," she insisted. "You can come back with some of Boris's men to help carry me."
"If they're still there, and if Pegasus doesn't find you first." He stood up a little unsteadily. "Forget it. You're coming along on this ride all the way." And he hoisted her to her feet. He made her count aloud every step he took, and at every hundredth he paused and rested. Then he started the next 100, with her counting softly in his ear, clinging with both arms around his neck. The whole universe seemed to shrink in upon them, to the ground directly at his feet. They no longer saw the rock cliff on one side, nor the deep void of space on the other. When he lurched or jolted her, and the pain shot through her knee, she closed her eyes and tried not to let her voice betray it to him as she kept counting. When he rested, he had to lean against the cliff face, not trusting his legs to get him up again if he lay down. He dared not lower her to the ground. The effort of lifting her again would be too much. He no longer had the strength for it.
"It's almost dark," she whispered in his ear. "You must stop here for the night. It's enough for one day. You're killing yourself, Nicky." "Another 100, he mumbled. "No, Nicky. Put me down."
For answer, he pushed off from the rock wall with his shoulder and staggered on upwards.
"Count," he ordered. 51. 52, she obeyed.
Suddenly the gradient altered so sharply under his feet that he almost fell. The path had levelled out, and like a drunkard he reached up for a step that wasn't there. He staggered and then caught his balance. He stood teetering on the brink of the precipice and peered into the dusk ahead of him, at first unable to credit what he was seeing. There were lights in the gloom, and he thought that he had begun to hallucinate. Then he heard men's voices, and he shook his head to clear it and bring himself back to reality.
"Oh, dear God, you've made it. We're at the top, Nicky. There are the vehicles. You did it, Nicky. You did it."
He tried to speak, but his throat had closed up and no words came. He reeled forward towards the lights, and Rohan cried out weakly on his back,
"Help us here! Please help us!"
First in English and then in Arabic.
"Please help us!"
There were startled cries and the sounds of running men. Nicholas sank down slowly into the fine highland grass and let Rohan slide off his back. Dark figures gathered around them, chattering in Amharic, and friendly hands seized them and half-carried, half-dragged them towards the lights. Then a torch was shone into Nicholas's face and a very English voice said,
"Hello, Nicky. Nice surprise. I came down from Addis to look for your corpse. Heard you were dead."
"Bit premature, what?"
"Hello, Geoffrey. Good of you to take the trouble."
"I dare say you could use a cup of tea."
"You look a bit done in," said Geoffrey Tennant.
"Never realized that your beard had ginger and grey bits in it. Designer stubble, fashionable, suits you, actually."
Nicholas realized what a picture he must present, ragged and unshaven, filthy and haggard with exhaustion.
"You remember Dr. Alcimer? She's got a bit of a dicky knee. I wonder if you mind taking care of her?"
Then his legs gave way under him, and Geoffrey Tennant caught him before he fell.
"Steady on, old boy."
He led him to a canvas-backed camp chair and seated him solicitously. Another chair was brought for Rayan.
"Let a chai happer!"
Geoffrey gave the universal call of an Englishman in Africa, and minutes later thrust mugs of steaming, over-sweetened tea into their hands. Nicholas saluted Rayan with his mug.
"Here's to us. There's none like us."
They both drank deeply, scalding their tongues, but the caffeine and sugar hit their bloodstreams like a charge of electricity.
"Now I know I'm going to live," Nicholas sighed.
"Don't want to be too pushy, Nicky, but do you mind telling me what the hell is going on here?" Geoffrey asked.
"Why don't you tell me?" Nicholas countered.
He needed time to evaluate the situation. What did Geoffrey know, and who had told him? Geoffrey obliged immediately.
"First thing we heard was that white hunter chappie of yours, Brusilov, had been fished out of the river near the Sudanese border, absolutely riddled with bullet holes. The crocs and catfish had snacked on his face, so the border police identify him by the documents in his money belt."
Nicholas glanced across at Rayan and cautioned her with a frown.
"Last time we saw him, he went off on a scouting expedition on his own," Nicholas explained. "He probably ran into the same bunch of shufter who raided our camp 4 nights ago."
"Yes, we heard about that too. Colonel Nogo here radioed in a report to Addis."
Neither of them had recognized Nogo in the crowd of men. It was only when he stepped forward into the light of the camp lanterns that Rayan stiffened, and such an expression of loathing flashed across her face that Nicholas reached across surreptitiously and took her hand to restrain her from any indiscretion. After a moment she relaxed and composed her features.
"I am very relieved to see you, Sir Quentin Harper. You have given us all a very worrying few days," said Nogo.
"I do apologize," Nicholas said smoothly.
"Please, sir, I meant no offence. It is just that we had a report from the Pegasus Exploration Company that you and Dr. Alcimer had been caught up in a blasting accident. I was present when Mr. Helm of the Exploration Company warned you that they were conducting blasting in the gorge."
"But you—"
Rayan flared bitterly, and Nicholas squeezed her hand hard to stop her going on.
"It was probably our own carelessness, as you suggest. Nevertheless, Dr. Alcimer has been injured, and we are both badly shaken up by the accident. More important than that, however, is the fact that a number of other people, camp staff and monks from the monastery, have been killed in the Shufter raid and in the blasting accident. As soon as we get back to Addis, I will make a full statement to the authorities."
"I do hope that you don't think any blame attaches—" Nogo started, but Nicholas cut him short.
Of course not, not your fault at all. You warned us about the danger of Shufter in the gorge. You were not present, so what could have been done to prevent any of this? I would say that you have done your duty in a most exemplary fashion."
Nogo looked relieved.
"You are most gracious to say so, Sir Quentin Harper."
Nicholas studied him for a moment longer.
He seemed the most amiable of young men, behind the metal-rimmed spectacles, so concerned and eager to please.
For a moment Nicholas almost believed that he had been mistaken, and that it had been somebody else that he had seen in the Jet Ranger, hovering over the avalanche site like a vulture, searching for their dead bodies. Nicholas forced himself to smile in his most friendly manner.
"I would be most grateful if you could do me a favour, Colonel."
"Of course," Nogo agreed readily.
"Anything at all.
I left a bag and one of my hunting trophies in the cavern under the Dandera waterfall. The bag contains our passports and travellers' checks. Very grateful if you could send one of your men down to bring it up for me." While giving Nogo directions on how to find his possessions, he derived a perverse enjoyment from sending his would-be assassin on such a trivial errand. Then he turned back to his friend so that Nogo would not pick up the vindictive glint in his eyes. "How did you get here, Geoffrey?"
"Light plane to Debra Mariam. There's an emergency landing field there. Colonel Nogo met us and brought us the rest of the way by army jeep," Geoffrey explained. "The pilot and the aircraft are waiting for us at Debra Mariam."
Geoffrey broke off and spoke to the camp staff in execrable Amharic, before turning back to Nicholas.
"I've just arranged a hot bath for you and Dr. Alcimer. After that, a meal and a good night's sleep should work wonders. Tomorrow we can fly back to Addis. No reason why we shouldn't be there by tomorrow evening at the latest."
He patted Royan's shoulder, disguising his carnal interest in her behind a benign avuncular smile.
"I must say I'm rather pleased not to have to go traipsing down into the Abbey Gorge looking for the pair of you. I hear that it's a pretty beastly part of the world."
"Do you mind, Dr. Alcimer, if I sit in front? Terribly rude of me, but I'm inclined to suffer from mild air."
"Ha, ha, ha," Geoffrey explained to Ryan, as they waited for three small boys to chase the goats off the emergency airfield at Debra Mariam. In the meantime, Nicholas was stuffing the roll of Dick Dickskin under the rear passenger seat. One of Nogo's sergeants had made a night descent of the escarpment and had delivered both his bag and the skin while they were breakfasting that morning. Nogo gave them a smart salute as they taxied out in a cloud of dust. Nicholas waved and smiled at him through the side window, murmuring, "Screw you, Nogo, screw you very much indeed." When at last the pilot lifted the little Cessna 260 off the rough grass strip, the horizon over the Abbey Gorge resembled a field of cosmic mushrooms, vast thunderheads reaching up into the stratosphere. The air beneath them was turbulent as a storm sea, and they were thrown about mercilessly in the rear seats. Up in front, Geoffrey seemed to be faring no better. He was very quiet and took no interest in their conversation. There had been no opportunity for them to talk privately the previous evening, what with either Geoffrey or Nogo hovering within earshot at all times. Now, with their heads close together, the engine beat covering their voices, and Geoffrey occupied with his own queasy thoughts, they were able to concoct their story. Geoffrey had made it clear that the British ambassador in Addis was less than delighted with the inconvenience they had caused him. Apparently there had been a string of faxes from Whitehall since they had been reported missing. Added to that, the Ethiopian Commissioner of Police was anxious to question them. They had to make sure that they did not implicate Mek Demir in the killing of Boris Brusilov, and at the same time they must not alert or alarm Pegasus in any way. They realised that the reaction from that quarter would be swift and probably lethal if they gave the least suspicion that they knew who the other players were in Taita's game. Most of all, they must avoid antagonising the Ethiopian authorities, or give them any cause to cancel their visas and declare them to be undesirable immigrants. They agreed to feign ignorance and play the role of innocents caught up in affairs which they had not precipitated and which they did not understand. By the time they had landed in Addis Ababa, they had prepared their story and rehearsed it thoroughly. As soon as the Cessna pulled on to the hard stand in front of the airport buildings, and the pilot cut the engine, Geoffrey came back to life again, only a little green around the gills, and handed Royan down the aircraft steps with a flourish. "Of course, you will stay at the residence," he told them. "The hotels in town are too dreadful to contemplate, and H.E. has a half-decent chef and a passable wine cellar. I'll rustle up some togs for both of you. My missus is about the same size as you, Dr. Alcimer, and Nicky will fit into my gear at a pinch. Thank God I have a spare dinner jacket. H.E. is a bit of a stickler for form."